From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made 27 days from today in Iowa for the 2020 Iowa caucuses. After what feels like an endless campaign, finally there will be voting. 8 days after Iowa, of course, New Hampshire votes. And two new polls from CBS News find that if those events were held today, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders could sweep them. Sanders has pulled into a three-way tie for the lead in Iowa with 23% support, tied with Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg, and Sanders has edged ahead in New Hampshire with 27% compared to 25% for Biden. Of course, those two small, non-diverse states don't decide the whole thing, but NPR points out that in the past 40 years, only Bill Clinton has become a presidential nominee for their party without winning Iowa or New Hampshire. If it comes down to Sanders and Biden, there are some significant differences between the voting bases. Sanders voters are highly enthusiastic about voting for their candidate. Biden voters are not. But Biden voters view the former vice president as the safe choice, and even some Sanders supporters agree, according to the CBS poll. Well, this hour is a chance to explore the Sanders candidacy, what it represents, and why supporters think he is gaining more traction as we get closer to voting. One of the first people who I knew in Rochester to be an enthusiastic Sanders person was Mary Lupien, who was a longtime supporter of Sanders and a member of Rochester City Council. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Also with us is Karen Vitale, who is the co-founder of the Rochester chapter of Democratic Socialists of America. Welcome back to you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. Good afternoon.
And Donald Martell is here, who is a Sanders delegate. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, Mary, is this like the, you know, is this the finally I told you so moment? You're not there yet?
No. I think we've got some time to go. But for me, this feels very full circle. You know, my political career started with Bernie Sanders. I was someone that didn't really believe in the political system, and he inspired me to get involved and then showed me that I could actually make a difference. And now, you know, I was just sworn into city council, and I followed, you know, what he said to do, which is if you want social change, you got to stand up and run for local office yourself. And now I have the, you know, privilege to be running again as a delegate for Bernie Sanders. And so I'm really excited. I think that from what I've seen from the two campaigns, you know, last time and this time, we were very much on our own last time. We were doing whatever we thought we needed to do. We did an amazing job locally, but we were all new people. We didn't really have much political experience. And this time, you know, we have a person from the campaign already helping us petition, and things are infinitely more organized, and he's raising way more money. So I'm really excited, and I think he's going to do really well.
Karen, what do you make of the recent polling, given the fact that we're still 4 weeks away from voting? We know things can change, and we know the media over-obsesses about polls, me among them, but what do you make of what you're seeing?
Well, I'm very excited. I think that what we're seeing may be surprising to some people because they've been perhaps relying on mass media to figure out what is going on in the Democratic primary race. But Bernie has consistently been fundraising from average working people in huge numbers and huge amounts and building a ground game. I'm very encouraged by a couple of things that have happened in the past 6 months or so. Bernie has outraised other candidates from people who have to do with national security in their work lives. So the State Department, the military, the Justice Department, the Department of Homeland Security, Bernie has led, at least back in August, had raised more money from those families than Trump and Biden combined. And I think that's particularly salient given our current military political moment, is to understand that Bernie is electable and is getting support from places that people who haven't been paying attention may be surprised by.
Yeah, I wonder, Karen, if that is maybe part of why someone like Ben Smith, who's been writing about politics for years, is with BuzzFeed. He thought that the events out of Iran and Iraq over the last 5 days now, or whatever the case may be since Soleimani was killed, he believes that this may be the moment that actually cinches the nomination for Bernie Sanders, not for Joe Biden, not for someone more centrist or more ostensible national security experience. Do you think even those donation totals, do you think that sort of give a little window into what maybe turns narratives on its head?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're living in a new modern political age, and a lot of surprising things have been happening, including 2016. And I think you're hearing a lot of younger voters, and now we're hearing that, you know, two-thirds, like beyond the margin of error for the poll, two-thirds of current military personnel and veterans of the military have said that they don't think that the wars in the Middle East are worth it. That's astounding. That's really important that politicians listen to.
And frankly, the media, because of these narratives that sort of get entrenched. And by the way, the poll she's citing is an accurate one. Donald Martel is a Sanders delegate. What do you make of at least the polling that you're seeing now out of the early states?
So, Bernie's has a solid base, and the polling reflects that. So in New Hampshire, which is right next to his home state, he's been leading for months now, if not since polls came out. And in Iowa, he's slowly gaining traction, and the polls actually don't reflect exactly how strong the Sanders campaign is, and we can see that in the last election. So a lot of what Bernie does is he gets new voters into the fold. He gets younger people who may not have been able to vote in the last election, and this helps him gain a bigger base that's not typically called in polls. So when you take a poll, it's usually likely caucus goers or likely primary voters. That's the people who have voted two out of the last three primaries, let's say, or caucuses, and they're likely to be supporters, or they're likely to vote supporting whomever. Now, Bernie, he can gain another 5% in the actual voting total versus what the polls are, just because of how he gets his support and how he builds a base. It's very grassroots. He's bringing new people in who are apathetic to the voting process, and he's really just, again, building a base from the ground up. He's not just doing it on name recognition.
So listeners, as we go throughout this hour, you ought to know a little bit about how the Connections team views coverage of politics like this. I have never been a big fan of horse race politics, and I'm sort of happy to see the Mark Halperins of the world sidelined, just because I think that just focusing on horse race is not really helpful. What we try to do is we try to cover the whys of the movements. And we're going to talk about some of the issues that are animating the Sanders movement, how they compare to other candidates, some of the recent comments from one of the biggest Bernie Sanders supporter, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and her view that if we were, for example, in Europe, that she and Pete Buttigieg or she and Joe Biden might not even be members of the same party. We're going to talk about that and how our guests view that. And so we will certainly tie it to the animating issues here. But I think the polling matters as we get this close now, because, again, if this were happening today, there's a good chance Bernie Sanders would sweep Iowa and New Hampshire and could be well on his way to the nomination. A lot could change in the next month, and if you want to join the program, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. I want to talk about the enthusiasm gap. So here's what the polling from CBS News and YouGov found. In New Hampshire, for example, 65% of Sanders backers call themselves enthusiastic about voting for him ahead of all other candidates. Only Elizabeth Warren supporters are also over 60%. Joe Biden is at the lowest number of enthusiasm. He's under 50%. So less of half of likely Joe Biden voters are basically saying, I'm kind of holding my nose. I feel like we've got to win. He's the safe choice. And we'll talk about what safe means in a moment here, but let's just talk about enthusiasm. How much, Mary Lupien, do you think it matters to have a candidate who has energized voters to get people excited to go vote? Not just vote against something, but to vote for something.
I mean, I think we saw what difference it makes in the last election. You know, Bernie, he entered the race really thinking he was going to be a protest candidate, and because of the enthusiasm he inspired, he really almost took it. I think, you know, it's not just the vote, right? It's the volunteers you inspire to really spread those seeds in the community. And I think he does that in spades. And for me, you know, always he's on the right side of the issue. Going back, you know, 30 years, he can say, I voted against this. I voted against that when everyone else did.
And you say always. I can find one or two.
Okay, maybe. Sure. You're right.
Gun control?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
But
no,
the bottom
and
line
he,
is, generally speaking.
Yes.
I think it would be bizarre to have any human being
sure.
find every single candidate. But I take
this
the point you're making.
For most of the issues that are personal to me, he's been on the right side, even when it's been uncomfortable and hard to stand alone. And he's been consistent.
Okay. Karen Vitale, how do you feel about the enthusiasm gap? I have no doubt that those numbers do not surprise you about who's energized to vote for their candidates versus who's not.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what I can add. It is very exciting. I think there's been a lot of talk, it's interesting, in the media lately about the end of the Bernie blackout, right? And what they're referring to is the observation that much of the reporting around Bernie Sanders until the last month or so has been quiet, negative, misleading. So there are polls where he may have been coming in second behind Biden, but he was listed fourth in the list. So it wasn't actually ranked by percentage, giving the impression that he was running fourth, even though he was maybe running second. The LA Times ignored the fact that Bernie had a rally with 14,500 people, and they ran five headlines before they mentioned the fact that Bernie had a rally in town that day. So there's been sort of this media Bernie blackout, and I think the enthusiasm, he's still building a ground game and raising money despite the fact that mass media has been ignoring or throwing shade on him. So I think that is also a measure of the enthusiasm that people have for him as a candidate.
I will say as a member of the media, I think some of that criticism is fair. I actually think the Yang campaign has a real complaint too. Andrew Yang is routinely, if they show six people in the Democratic primaries polling numbers, he's often left out even if he's got 4 or 5% in one of the early states. He'll be ignored or left out. And CNBC showed just the names of the candidates and then their faces. And they had the wrong Asian-American guy. This happened yesterday. The wrong guy. So, yes, the media sometimes locks into certain narratives or certain sort of small groups of candidates. And so I think that criticism from Karen is probably fair.
Now the media is reporting that the blackout is over. So hooray! The blackout, they instituted, they're now reporting on.
If you start winning states, you don't get to ignore it. Donald Martel, what do you make of the importance of enthusiasm for voters here?
Well, as a candidate, you need to have supporters that are enthusiastic enough and have the charisma to bring people out to volunteer. Because whether you're running for president or you're running for city council like Mary, you need to have people who like you enough, like your message enough, like your policy enough to go out into the cold, especially in Iowa and New York now with petitioning, to knock doors, collect signatures, canvass, get people to vote for you. And if you're someone like, Bloomberg or even Cory Booker, who's like 2% in the polls, you don't have a lot of enthusiasm. You don't have a lot of people, or like Joe Biden, who's not, you're going to have people who, okay, you know, I'll vote for you, but you're not going to be very excited about it. While Bernie's supporters are extremely enthusiastic. They're willing to go out, knock doors, control narratives, push back on media when they have a blackout or when they smear Bernie. And the same thing could be said about Andrew Yang or Tulsi Gabbard, because these candidates have things, actual issues that they care about and they're pushing for. Unlike Mayor Pete, he might speak a lot, but he doesn't really say anything because he doesn't speak with any substance or any policy. But when it comes to Bernie, when you think of him, think of Medicare for All, ending wealth inequality. When you think of Tulsi Gabbard, you think of ending foreign wars. When you think of Andrew Yang, think of UBI. And these are things that people can sink their teeth into, and they're new things that are coming about. And that's why those three candidates are hated by the mainstream media and the Democratic establishment.
And so it becomes a question then, as we go throughout this hour too, of addressing some of the assumptions that whether it's a mainstream media writer like John Chait or others have that, well, the winning elections is still in the middle. We'll talk about what the middle is. You should see the faces of the panelists when I said that. You should have just, if only a camera was on Donald Martel when I said that. Mary Lupien, Karen Vitale, and Donald Martel are here. We're talking about the Sanders candidacy and the recent polling out of the early states that indicate a real solid chance for Bernie Sanders to sweep the early states and get out ahead and maybe on his way to a nomination. Now, before we continue on this, let's grab our first phone call. It's our friend Jane in Rochester. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Joe Biden, he seems to always put his foot in his mouth, but I can't go for him because of 92 when he helped put Clarence Thomas on the court and he put Anita Hill on trial, and it just sort of soured me a little bit. Excuse me. But I like Bernie. I like what I hear him say. And yes, it's climate change, climate change, climate change. And I think that's the number one issue. And what was else I was going to say? And Elizabeth Warren, I was kind of torn between her and Bernie. But she had this sort of little dance around about capitalism, saying, oh, she loved capitalism. And I just was not comfortable with how much she loved it. She could have qualified it, saying restrained, responsible capitalism.
I think that's probably actually what she does say for the most part, Jane.
You think so?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, yeah, but it was just this particular time. Oh, boy, I really love it. I wish she loved it a little bit less. But anyway, and just with the climate, and Bernie has been so steady with his issues going on for decades and decades. He is so knowledgeable about everything. And that's what impressed me with Elizabeth Warren. She's so knowledgeable. But I believe Bernie is what we need right now.
All right, Jane, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Jane. So that phone call matches exactly one of the points I wanted to talk about, which is part of the polling finds a big shift just since November in the early voting states. And here's the shift. In November, if you combine the early voting states, Elizabeth Warren led the field with self-described true progressives, not moderates, not centrists, progressives. She's lost nearly half of that support, much of it to Bernie Sanders, since just November in the polling there. And what Jane is indicating is, I think this is the most important distinction we can probably make in the Democratic field. It's not even between Sanders and Biden, which is obvious or should be obvious. You hear a lot of people say, well, why not, you know, Elizabeth Warren? And I'll read an email in a moment about that. But Elizabeth Warren, I don't know if she says she loves capitalism, but she says, I'm a capitalist. Yes, I am a capitalist and I will support capitalism, but I believe it has to have rules and referees on the field, and right now we're allowing it untrammeled. Whereas I think the Sanders base does have an issue with that. And let me ask all three of you, if you think that's the distinction here, if we see the progressive support melting away from Elizabeth Warren in some degree, is that part of why? Is Jane's phone call, does that reflect it, Mary Lou Beal?
I think that's part of it. You know, I think that there is, you know, and we have Karen over here with the social,
the DSA.
DSA, Democratic Socialist. You know, I think there is a real shift here where we're evaluating how well has capitalism worked for most of the people in this country. And to really be a self-proclaimed capitalism lover and to say that we just need more rules and regulations, which I think, you know, is a dog whistle to Republicans. You know, they don't want more regulations and rules. But I don't think it's worked. I don't think we can regulate a system that is designed to benefit the owners and the people of the most money. I don't think it can work personally. And so I resonate with someone who's really talking about something new. And I think that he can be seen as a wild card or, you know, somebody radical, which I think is fair. But he's also a safer choice because with Bernie, we know what we're getting. You know, with any other candidate, they could surprise us. They could change course because of influence by money. But we know what we're getting with Bernie, and we know he's going to stick with what he said. So I feel like in a lot of ways, he is a safer choice.
Well, so let me follow up with you, Mary, before I turn to your co-panelists on that point. Candidates like Amy Klobuchar have been direct when asked about capitalism. Amy Klobuchar has essentially said, this country is not electing someone who's anti-capitalism. It's just not going to happen right now. And we need to be realistic about what will work, what can get done, and what people want. So what the sort of the Klobuchars of the world, and I'm sort of, I don't intend to speak for just one candidate, but the message seems to be, you got to be careful in a primary with just sort of appeasing an energized base as opposed to saying, how are we going to win in November? And Klobuchar saying, this is not the way to win. An anti-capitalism message is not the way to win. You apparently feel like that can change or that is not right.
Yeah, I feel like everyone's entitled to their opinion. I feel differently. You know, it's a different country than it was 4 years ago. But in that time, I was working in a soup kitchen with a lot of Republican Catholic volunteers. And I did my informal polling. And, you know, if they had a choice between Trump and Bernie, they were picking Bernie over Trump. But, you know, when it was Hillary and Trump, obviously they picked Trump. But there's something about his message that applies across the board. It's something, it's not business as usual. It's not, you know, tailoring to, you know, the muddied interests and what Trump said he was going to do and obviously didn't. But I think there's a lot of crossover appeal. And, you know, I think that people are willing to take a chance on something new because of how badly this system has failed us. And I think it's failed many, many Trump supporters as well.
Okay. Karen Vitale.
It's interesting. Vox has an article out today about making the best case for Bernie Sanders as a candidate, and I think they'll follow up with each of the Democratic primary mm-hmm. candidates to make the best case. But the first thing they say out of the gate is that he is somebody who has values in politics and is a pragmatic legislator. So that sort of like wild card, we don't know what Bernie's going to do. He's been serving in the Senate and as a politician for many years with a consistent message that he is for the people. So I'm not worried about the pragmatism. I think perhaps the way to understand this kind of narrative and debate is to consider that, yes, capitalists are going to be greedy. The question is, do you negotiate with them or do you call them out? And I want, if capitalists have their boots on the back of our necks, I want a politician who will say, their boot is on the back of my neck and I can't do anything about it. So let's put the spotlight where it belongs in that kind of dynamic. And I trust Bernie to do that. So yes, he is a pragmatic legislator who's going to work with the Congress that he has to work with. I have no question about that. But I think he's also going to lay blame where it belongs. And that's what I want. That's refreshing to me. That's what I want to hear.
Okay. And bluntly speaking, you're talking about what you want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
I have an email from Herman who's saying, you talk about the early voting states, but what about the swing states, which, what do we have, 6-7 states that are going to decide November, which is sort of an interesting prospect to begin with. But do you think an anti-capitalist message wins in the swing states, Karen?
I do, actually. I don't know if I mentioned this earlier on the show, but back in August, Bernie Sanders outperformed Biden and Trump in the 206 counties in the Midwest that voted Obama-Trump. So those counties that flipped for Trump and really made a difference in him getting elected early on have already been supporting Bernie in large numbers.
Okay. Donald, how do you feel about the capitalism question, particularly as it pertains to the general election?
Amy Klobuchar polls at 3%. That's all you need to know.
She's at 7 in Iowa and New Hampshire now. There is a Klobuchar if you haven't felt it.
3%.
That's mine, by the way.
3%.
That is entirely mine.
Trademark it.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to go anywhere. Go ahead.
3% nationally, 1.6% in California, 1.3% in South Carolina, 1.7% in Texas, 0.5% in Massachusetts.
Now you're just being
2% in New Hampshire. 2% Nevada. So Amy Klobuchar's message is a losing message. She's going to be out after New Hampshire.
I bet you Joe Biden would say the same. I bet you Joe Biden would say, and this is what Joe Biden says mm-hmm. publicly and privately, when he's in the room with billionaires, when he's in the room with hedge fund managers, he says, you are not the problem. I'm not going to demonize you. This country doesn't do that, and this country doesn't vote for that. Joe Biden says essentially the same.
Under the Obama administration that Joe Biden was the vice president of, and also Joe Biden's been in politics. He's been a senator since like 1974. So he's had the privilege of not feeling the legislation and the neoliberal policies. He's not felt those effects because he's been insulated from that. And that builds apathy towards the lower class. So 1,000 seats were lost under Obama and Pelosi and Biden, their leadership, 1,000 seats across the nation. And that's because the Democratic Party didn't stand for anything. They were saying, oh, we're capitalists. Well, guess what? People were hurting because of capitalism. Capitalism is an inherently unequal and violent system against people who are working for lower wages and longer hours and less safe conditions. And this is Joe Biden's support is high because of, in my mind, name recognition and what I call default support. So people, I think I was discussing this with, in the lobby earlier. So a lot of people think, oh, Joe Biden, yeah, okay, I know that name. Oh, yeah, he was Obama's vice president. Oh, I like Obama. He served for 8 years. He's a good statesman. Okay, I'll vote for Joe Biden. That's why 15% of Joe Biden's supporters say they're fervent supporters, while 67% say they're of Bernie supporters, say they're great supporters of Bernie Sanders, and they're going to vote for only him. So that's just this disconnect of being a capitalist is unenthusiastic, uninspiring, and just it's going to be a losing message because it's not 1992 anymore. We don't run centrist campaigns.
Well, and Donald, I don't seek to ask you to speak for an entire generation, but there is a generational divide
yes.
as to how generations of Americans viewed the words socialism and capitalism. If you're over the age of 50, and certainly over the age of 65, you've got a very pro-capitalism view and a very, very negative view of socialism. That's very generally speaking, and I know there's many exceptions. But younger adult Americans are seeing that change. You're in that category, so let me ask you, do you see benefits of capitalism?
Oh, of course. So I'm 24. Mm-hmm. So I definitely see the benefits of capitalism. So I consider myself politically a more libertarian social democrat. So
That is a fascinating
yes.
label.
So if you want to go to the political compass, the left being economic left, right being economic right, the top being authoritarian, the bottom being libertarian, I'm more like bottom left, kind of where like Chomsky would be. So anyway, I'd like to see capitalism in the small mindset benefiting small businesses. I'd like to have tax cuts to small businesses. I've never met a middle class tax cut that I've not liked. Well, I'd like to see regulation and taxes on corporations because we don't really live in a capitalist society anymore. We live in a corporatist society that benefits corporation, that is socialism for the rich and rugged individualism for the poor.
And again, I've got to be careful here, but I think that is Elizabeth Warren's message, effectively.
That's Bernie Sanders' message.
Okay. Well,
Elizabeth Warren, her rhetoric might be something different, but not only is the rhetoric watered down, her actions speak something different. She and her Senate campaigns... She raised money from those huge donors that she vilifies now. And even she bought into the premise, and she did an interview on TYT, The Young Turks, with Cenk Uygur, about how money in politics corrupts. She buys into that premise. And then just like her track record of selling her integrity out, she said in the general election, I'm going to go back on that, and I'm going to accept these big money fundraisers because we have to come out all guns blazing or whatever she said. So she buys into the premise and then walks it back. I mean, between that and not endorsing Bernie in 2016, I always am going to have a bad taste in my mouth when it comes to Elizabeth Warren. I don't want her as president. I want Bernie Sanders, someone who's going to fight, someone who has the right policy, someone who has courage, someone who has integrity to be my president.
Let me get Sarah's email. Evan, as a proud Democrat and a 44-year-old woman, I must say I'm appalled at the idea of an old white man getting the nomination. It would be one thing if there were no other options, but we have an excellent field of candidates. I don't particularly like the centrists, and I'm sick about the idea of Joe Biden as our nominee, but when you have Elizabeth Warren and Julian Castro and so many other true progressives, why isn't that good enough? Why claim to care about progress, but then elevate the 80-year-old white men? That is from Sarah.
Well, Julian is out now.
Yeah, he is. He endorsed Elizabeth Warren this week, but yes.
I can relate to that. I would love to not vote for an older white man, but...
You can relate to the sentiment of that email.
Yeah, absolutely. We need diversity. We need women. I would love to vote for a woman president, but the same as last time I had this choice. It has to be the right woman. And, you know, I would obviously vote for Elizabeth Warren over Trump, and I would be fairly happy should she get it, but... Bernie is the right president for this moment in time. We are at a juncture in our history where we're really deciding between extinction or not. And I think we got to get this right. We have to get someone who is uncompromising and who's going to lead us into the new age, not being hindered by the same tropes that kept us in this situation in the past. And that is taking money from corporate donors and letting that interest lead our policy.
Karen Vitale, what would you say to Sarah in her email?
I think Mary did a great job responding to that. I guess I'll use a very contrasting, very extreme example of where I come into this as a democratic socialist for the last 30 years. When Ivanka Trump runs for president in 2024, a lot of women will have a hard time pulling the lever for her and believing that we just need to vote for the woman candidate. There are so many axes, I guess is what I want to say. It's like a sound mixing board. I am not only interested in having female candidates. I'm interested in having women of color candidates. I'm interested in having men of color candidates. I'm interested in economic justice. Being anti-racist, being a feminist, being pro-gay rights, being pro-disability rights, those are the low-hanging fruits of human decency. That is the bare minimum. But where the pavement, where your foot hits the pavement, is in economic justice for all of those groups. So just deciding that we need to vote for the women candidates over the male candidates isn't enough for me. I'm at a sound mixing board, and I'm looking at all of those different levers, and Bernie Sanders continues to line up on all of the issues that are important to me, including feminism and reproductive rights and gay rights.
And to be clear here, to voters like Sarah, if Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren or any woman in the field had exactly the same policies, do you find yourself more likely, all issues being equal, to vote for the woman?
Probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
But in this case, you do not look at Sanders and Warren and say close enough. You see a big gap.
You know, I'm like Mary. I would say close enough when it comes to the election in November, but we're in a primary right now where I am weighing different candidates' positions, and I want to vote for the thing that most closely aligns with what's important to me, and Bernie ticks those boxes for me.
Okay. Fair enough. Donna, what would you say to Sarah?
So I understand the need for identity politics, but maybe I'm privileged enough as a white male not to, I don't want to play identity politics. The way I weigh politicians is, one, their policy, two, their integrity, and three, their courage to fight for those policies. So if you have the right policies, you have the integrity to always vote the same way, no matter how many lobbyists are trying to knock at your door, no matter how much pressure from the Democratic neoliberal leadership is pressing on you to vote the right way, then I'm going to like you. And if you have the courage to also speak out and say, you know what, this isn't right. We need Medicare for all. We need tuition-free public colleges and universities. We need to end the wars. We need a $15 minimum wage. We need to tax and regulate Wall Street. Then I'm going to like you. I don't care about your identity. I mean, yes, I'm a huge Bernie Sanders supporter, but aside from Bernie, none of my favorite politicians are old white men. Bernie's the first person that I've gone out, or first old white man that I've knocked doors for. I've knocked doors and petitioned for Mary, for Jumaane Williams, for Robin Wilt, for Cynthia Nixon, for I'm sure there's a few other ones in there, but those are the people that I go out and knock doors for. My favorite politicians, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Julia Salazar, Ilhan Omar, they're all fantastic women of color, and I don't like them because they're women of color. I like them because they are fantastic progressives who have courage and who have integrity and have the right policy. That's why I support them, not based on identity politics.
Let's get our only break of the hour. When we come back, he mentioned Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who said recently that if we were in a different country, especially if we're in Europe, that she, Bernie Sanders, you know, they would probably not be in the same political party as some of the so-called centrists who are running for president. That's an interesting comment. I wonder if our guests agree with that. We're also going to take more of your feedback at 844-295-TALK as we talk about Bernie Sanders, his candidacy, and the issues that are animating a very enthusiastic base of support that, based on the polling, could be enough to win the early states and propel him to a nomination. Mary Lupien, Karen Vitale, Donald Martell, all here, and we'll take more of your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, comedian Ricky Gervais lit up Hollywood with his monologue for the Golden Globes this past weekend. He told Hollywood, "You're boring, your movies aren't good, no one watches them anymore anyway, and by the way, you're all hypocrites." Rough, maybe funny, but we're going to talk about the themes, whether Gervais was right about certain things, next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You're never going to believe this, panelists, but you have inspired a lot of feedback. A lot of feedback as we talk about the Sanders candidacy. Let's get back to your phone calls. Matt in Rochester is next. Go ahead, Matt.
Hey, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
If we're sick of, or we don't want to vote for old white men, and we don't, you know, we don't want the centrist per se, and we want more of a progressive platform. I don't understand why more people aren't paying attention to Andrew Yang. I think UBI is a better plan than the $15 minimum wage. It's essentially the same dollar amount compared to the federal minimum wage now. I think it speaks to women's issues the most, women that are in abusive relationships or being exploited at work. I think that his plan is essentially the same as Bernie's Medicare for All, because Bernie's plan is phased in over years, same as Yang's. It's just he's not getting rid of private insurance, which a lot of union workers negotiated their health care in comparison to their wages. I'd like to hear what you guys say.
All right. Matt, thanks for the phone call. Karen, you and the Yang Gang now.
I'm glad that Yang is in the race, and I'm glad that that UBI is inspiring a lot of interest. I want to speak to the point about maintaining private insurance while also having Medicare for all. And the technical wonky reason that that's problematic is that we need everybody in community rating. We need people who are very healthy paying into a system at the same time that people who are not very healthy, who are very sick, are paying into a system in order to afford Medicare for all. So what happens with private insurance industries when there's still a marketplace for them is that they choose the youngest, healthiest people to insure, so that people who are in the public option are the oldest, the sickest, can't get insurance on the private marketplace, and are the costliest. So basically, you have an insurance company picking the healthiest people who are the cheapest to pay for and walking off with a bunch of profit at the same time that you're expecting the government to cover the sickest and least healthy people. And when I say the oldest and least healthy, that's not the same category of people. I'm talking about children with leukemia. I'm talking about people who are 50 years old and have multiple health conditions. Talking about somebody who's in a car accident. Those are expenses in the system, and the only way for the public option to work well and to really give us the health care that we deserve, we need everybody in. So that's just the comment that I want to make about that. Maintaining a private system with private insurers means that you're maintaining private profit that doesn't go toward care.
Canada and the UK still have private insurance, though, don't they?
But they're all in the same system. It's a very different option than what we're looking at with Medicare for those who want it.
Okay. You want to add to that, Donald?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, while we have the public option, I completely 110% agree with everything Karen said. But on top of having the public option, you're going to have those same companies who are still profiting, those private companies that are still profiting from the system. They're going to be funneling money into the centrist Democrat, blue dog wing of the party, and the Republican Party, and they're going to be chronically underfunding that public option. So when it fails, we say, oh, poof, look, oh, I guess, public funding of institutions, health institutions, I guess it doesn't work, even though it works in every other first world country. So, I mean, to your point about Canada and France and Australia, places like them, they do have supplemental private care, but it can't be duplicative. So if it's break your leg, that's covered under Medicare for all, but you can't have private insurance for that. You can have private insurance if you want to get plastic surgery or something like that. So that's why single payer needs to be universal. And that's also one of the benefits of UBI. When it's universal, it's going to be just like Social Security or Medicare. It's going to have a much higher approval rating than welfare. When you think of, oh, that person's on welfare, think of, that person's poor, we don't like them. But when someone says, oh, I'm on Medicare, think, oh, they're on Medicare, good for them, they're getting health care. So there's definitely a different mindset with universal programs versus non-universal programs, and that could doom it.
Let me get Henry from Brighton on the phone next. Go ahead, Henry.
Hi, Evan. Good to talk to you. I just am responding to some of the comments about Elizabeth Warren with the various Bernie supporters. And one of the things that's really frustrated me about the public discourse about Bernie versus Warren is I think it really ignores the history of who Elizabeth Warren was before the 2016 elections, and how MoveOn.org and all these left-wing organizations were campaigning to get her to be their standard bearer. And she wasn't that time. Bernie stepped up, and that's wonderful. But in the activist spaces of her campaign offices, and I've knocked a few doors for her, it's also full of truly left-wing, wonderful people, young men and women who dream all the same dreams as Bernie supporters. And I think that in evaluating the two candidates and picking one to stand up for, we need to recognize that they have a lot of the same energy, a lot of the same fervor for systemic change. and just to remember that. I also think that one thing that's been really unacknowledged is the work that Bernie needs to do in unifying the party behind him, if he is our nominee. And that's something, that's why I support Elizabeth Warren, is because I think she can tap into the activist wellspring of energy and also unify people who are divided from the last election.
All right, Henry, thank you very much. Can Warren offer that unification? Can Sanders offer that unification? Karen?
Sure. I mean, I think that a progressive that gets elected is going to pull the party behind them. We've seen Bernie do that to some extent without getting elected. I'm glad that Elizabeth Warren is in the race. And if she is the candidate come November, I will happily, happily pull the trigger for Elizabeth Warren.
Okay. Mary?
I think a lot of why, you know, we're so divided is because so many blame Bernie supporters and Bernie himself for losing the election to Trump. And I think, you know, that goes away when we're fighting for him to beat Trump. You know, I think any Democrat is going to unify us because we have this huge existential fight ahead of us and we have to come together.
Okay, Donald?
I agree with a lot of what Henry said. I understand that Elizabeth Warren is trying to bridge that gap. But at the same time, I think when Bernie wins the nomination, he'll have the grassroots of the party. The party's with him. The leadership is not. The leadership and their friends in the mainstream media who all have their wine fundraisers in Martha's Vineyard and all those places, they're not going to like Bernie. But we have the people behind us, and I think the people are going to align with Bernie. And those progressives that are Warren supporters now, they will gladly support Bernie. Just like I know most Bernie, if not all Bernie supporters, are going to gladly support Warren if she's the nominee. But
would you support Biden? Would you vote for Biden, Donald?
I think about it, but I'd probably vote Green.
Karen?
I'd have a really hard time pulling the lever for Biden.
He's a conservative.
But I say that in the context of a district that's going to go Democrat no matter how I vote.
Yes. If you're in a swing state, would it change for you? Would you vote
It would probably change for me.
I agree.
How would it feel?
Like it felt pulling the trigger for Hillary Clinton. I mean, listen, elections are not my only participation in the democracy of this country. I think people get wrapped up in essentializing the experience of it as, well, you have to vote. And if you vote, you have to do this and you have to do that. And if you don't, you're not a patriot and all of that kind of stuff. But I'm probably more politically engaged than at least 50% of the U.S. population, at least, I'm guessing. And so my elections are not the end-all be-all of democracy. I wish that there were an option on the ballot that says I don't like any of these. I do go and vote even if I don't pull a lever on a particular line. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of subtleties about U.S. political participation that sort of go away during election season. So, yeah, I'm not in a swing state. I'm not in a swing district. And currently there are so few ways that I can have my voice heard by the Democratic Party that I belong to that I protest showing up and having a protest vote is not nothing.
Okay. Mary, would you vote for Joe Biden?
If I were in a swing state, yes. I don't know how I would vote, to be honest, if I'm in Monroe County. I mean, probably, but depends on, you know, who the other candidates are that align with my views.
I'll just say one thing about looking at the Democratic field. One of the things I think to myself is which candidates are going to go in and on their first day of office undo every Trump executive order? And I trust Warren to do that. I trust Bernie Sanders to do that. I don't trust Biden to do that because a lot of those executive orders are benefiting the same corporate sponsors that much of the centrist Democrats have funding their campaigns.
What's an example of the kinds of orders?
I don't know because there's been so many, Evan. Lot, yeah. Who can even keep up with all of them?
Deregulating meat. They're not, they're taking away the regulations.
Street, environmental protections.
Yeah.
Also, I'm thinking that when somebody comes out as a Democratic primary candidate in 2020 and suggests that we really need to work across the aisle with white supremacist Republicans, That's in order to win an election. That's disgusting to me. And that's somebody who's actually going to keep some of those executive orders in place that are pro-capitalism or are pro our friends who give us money. I mean, I don't know.
But on that point, though, let me read a comment from Alex who writes in, and I think would probably agree that working with white supremacists is not the goal here, but he does say the following. So the idealism of presidential politics is, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, yet the president proposes it and Congress disposes of it. The question is what happens when Sanders is president and the Senate and likely the House after the impeachment debacle, being Republican, how do your guests see President Sanders succeeding in office with those dynamics? That's fair.
That's a fair question.
But I think we see what Trump is doing now without Congress. I think there's, you know.
So part of what Karen is saying is he may run into some gridlock with Congress, but just the executive orders alone that could be undone matter. The choices of judgeships matter. Do you think legislation could pass? Do you think Medicare for All, for example, could get done?
I'll tell you what could get done regarding Medicare for All.
Okay.
A president, let's just say for the sake of argument, President Sanders today, any president can sign a waiver that allows states to set up single-payer health care for their state, like we have in New York State. We have the New York Health Bill, Health Act, that is on the table. They can provide a presidential waiver to allow a demonstration project to see how it would go at the state level to have single-payer health care. That's really important. I think that there is something to be said for popular support for one's platform and the ways that that changes the minds of people who are in office. If progressives are elected into office, people have to move to be more progressive, even in Republican states. So let's try it out. Let's try it out. Do an experiment and find out.
Okay. You want to add to that, Donald? Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, this whole idea of working with Republicans is kind of a joke. You know, if we say a lot of the left vilifies the Republicans, and they're so evil, they're so, we don't want them, their legislation is horrible, and then the centrist Democrats run to do legislation with them, and like the legislation that they pass as, so what Biden likes to brag about is about getting things done, but what does he get done? Voting for the Iraq War, you know, Clarence Thomas as was, and Anita Hill as was mentioned earlier, deregulation of Wall Street, larger military budgets. Those are the things that gets done. So why get things done? It's about what you get done, not just getting things done. And like as Biden and other centrist Democrats do, they're elected as weak opposition, as paid weak opposition. So when you rig a boxing match, you don't pay the winner. You pay a loser. You pay the loser to lose. That's what the centrist Democrats are. They're paid to lose by the same donors. And so what happens is that Republicans propose staunch conservative legislation. Democrats barely water it down. They then accept defeat. They sell it to their base, and they call it incremental progress. And this half-measure approach has gotten us Trump. It's lost us 1,000 seats, and it's why we're not living in 1992 anymore. It's 2020. We want progressivism. We want a full-throated approach. The way you deal with a bully like Mitch McConnell isn't by asking him politely, hey, can we have Medicare for All? No. You politically rip his head off and shove Medicare for All down his throat.
That's
winning the hearts and minds.
That's interesting.
We're on the same page.
Yes.
I love how Karen describes that as winning the hearts and minds. Real quick here, Rachel says that Elizabeth Warren lost her by backing off a stronger position on Medicare for All and then spouting some industry talking points.
Truth.
So that's where Rachel is. And Dan says the safe vote should be Sanders because of the following. It's centrist Democrats who have this blue no matter who idea.
Mm-hmm.
And the progressive wing is not likely to be as much blue no matter who. It matters more to the progressive wing. And for progressives, the safe choice would be Sanders. So Dan says, therefore, the safe choice is Sanders.
Truth.
But let me just ask all of you briefly here in our last 3 minutes or so. When Ocasio-Cortez says if we were in Europe, Sanders and Biden wouldn't even be in the same party. Ocasio-Cortez and Buttigieg wouldn't be in the same political party. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean,
do you feel like in this country it's strange that you would vote for a Democrat and Joe Biden is a Democrat? Do you think that Biden and Sanders are effectively different?
Yeah, at the risk of making people feel uncomfortable about American democracy, it's really bizarre in the rest of the world that we have two political parties, essentially. So, I mean, give us five political parties, give us 10 political parties, give us coalition governments. I mean, two really, I mean, two political parties is really bizarre.
I think Kasich and Trump don't belong in the same party either. Yeah. You know, it's we got to fit everybody into two categories, and we're not, humans aren't like that.
Yeah, so, I mean, take, I saw this example, I think, on Twitter about Canada. So, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez would be in the same party as Jagmeet Singh, who's leading the NDP, while the centrist party, led by Trudeau, the Liberal Democrats or whatever their name is, that would be for Mayor Pete, that would be a perfect party for him. While the Conservative Party would be for, you know, like Kasich or mainstream Republicans, while they're even further right parties in Canada, I'm not sure what they are, that would be for people like Trump or Mitch McConnell. So it would be nice to have an actual leftist party, because we have a centrist, we have a party that's at best 5% to the left and at worst 10% to the right, and that's the Democratic Party. And then we have the Republican Party, which is off the deep end and no left-wing party.
All right, last question. Karen Vitale, why is it that you think then that some Sanders supporters would still vote for Donald Trump?
I think it's interesting. That's an interesting way to frame the question.
Well, I think that's what Dan's email implies, that the safe choice for progressives would be Sanders because they're not as likely to be a blue no matter who.
There's more than two choices.
Yeah, but
that's fair.
Right.
You said they could go green. Yeah.
They could show up and not vote on that line.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's but
and you know what? Let me also be a little fairer. The number of Sanders supporters who voted for Trump is not fundamentally different than the number of Clinton voters who didn't vote for Obama, et cetera. I mean, there's always 10 to 11 or 12% of a base of support that doesn't go along. It wasn't fundamentally different. So it wasn't there wasn't a huge block of Sanders supporters voted for Trump, but I understand wanting to get every last one of them in the swing states. So as we wrap the show, who's going to win this nomination? Honestly, who do you think's winning the nomination?
Bernie.
Bernie has the most support, most donors, 5 million contributors. He's got every metric.
Ground game.
Yes.
Would you have said the same 4 years ago?
I
no.
wasn't as politically yeah. engaged 4 years ago.
Not at this
ago.
Point.
No. So you think it's different this time around?
I do.
You
yeah.
think Sanders is the nominee? And if it's not Sanders, who do you think it's going to be? I would say the polling right now says it's Biden. If
just
it's not
Bernie
Sanders.
And Biden are the only two that have a shot.
I hope it's Warren if it's not Bernie.
Or Bernie and Warren on the same ticket.
I'd rather have Nina Turner as my vice president.
Notice what I have been, listeners. I ask them, if not, then who? And they tell us what their hopes are. But, but I appreciate the time. Mary Lupien, Karen Vitale, Donald Martell, thank you very much for taking the time. It's 27 days away from the Iowa caucuses. More connections coming up.